Hello and welcome to this episode of the 21cc podcast. I'm Nadine Badu, editor of CM People. Today we're putting the spotlight on clients and delving into what they actually want from their contractors and supply chain before, during and after a project. CIOB, in partnership with the Institute of Asset Management, brought together a group of clients for a roundtable discussion to discuss their expectations, frustrations and what good really looks like during delivery. Coming up, you'll hear from three of the attendees: Julie Blight, Property and Contracts Manager at Royal Devon NHS Foundation Trust, Dan Hollis, Building Safety Director at Clarion Housing Group, and Jason Glasson, Head of Asset Management Development at National Highways. You'll hear real insights, real experiences, and some valuable advice for all construction professionals. The roundtable was chaired by my colleague Will Mann, editor of Construction Management Magazine. And he kicked off the discussion by asking what the most important benchmark is for clients when working with contractors and suppliers and how they measure performance against this.
So we're probably slightly different in the fact that it's public purse and our value for money is very much centred around how they work in collaboration with us, because whatever happens, the hospital has to operate. So extensions, refurbishments, it's always about keeping that hospital operational at all cost almost. So you need a contractor that can work with you, develops and be innovative with you to make sure that you keep going in that right direction. And then we've always got targets to meet, like winter pressures, or they, you know, with during COVID particularly, we don't have the luxury of going too far past the end date, and we don't have the luxury of, if it goes over budget, we don't have that luxury either. So it's very much got to be collaborative working.
Jason Glasson.
I think as far as National Highways is concerned, our key thread that runs through everything we do really is safety. And we make no bones about it. We are obsessed with safety, both of our customers, our own people and our supply chain staff. And so in terms of suppliers working with us, they're ensuring the safety of their own workforce is absolutely paramount to us. And there are a number of measures for that: accident frequency rate based around RIDDOR reported incidents. That's very, very closely monitored, and we are absolutely challenging and scrupulous in driving down that accident frequency rate sort of year on year, obviously aiming for zero harm to suppliers and our own staff. And so I'd say without a doubt that single most important factor for us in throughout every project, every routine element of work that we do is safety.
Our focus is primarily on quality, the quality of construction, and our ability as a client to determine that quality we see as central to what we do. If you think about the context of what we found after the Grenfell Tower fire and our investigations into external wall systems, you can see that there are a significant amount of buildings that were built to the right cost, probably at the right time, but were they built to the right quality? And for us to be able to fix those buildings, to make them fit for purpose, we need to make sure that we focus on that quality of construction all the way through the process. Now, that incorporates elements around, particularly for us, around the competence of the, competence for ourselves as a client, but also our professional consultants and the constructors that we've got.
Thanks, everyone. We'll move on to the second question now. What innovations do you look for from contractors and suppliers, particularly in areas such as sustainability, data and digital innovation, quality, health and safety? And how do you encourage these innovations, which could be through the contract or some other incentive? What blockers are there to innovation?
So being part of the NHS, we're part of the net zero by 2030. Money is tight, to say the least, probably for the NHS at the moment. So we are largely working on refurbishments, small extensions. So recycling of materials is quite critical for items that are coming out. Local supply chains, local labour. So to try and minimise the carbon and the petrol and that sort of thing. All our new buildings, we are trying to design in the ability to connect to a future district heating network, which is making it a little bit of a challenge for an NHS building and district heating networks, because the two don't necessarily go hand in hand. We're looking at modern methods of construction for units, so preformed toilets, bathrooms, those sorts of things that can just be tacked on, minimizing the noise, minimizing dust, but fast turnaround. And really, you know, it's about the contractor trying to come up with some innovation, which is quite challenging at times when budgets are so strict.
Thank you, Julie. Over to Dan Hollis.
Yeah, I think for us, obviously, it's got to fit in within the framework of our goals. For us, we're aiming towards 2050. I think one of the things that as a client we can do is think about those, setting out those requirements at the start of a project. So for all our external wall system remediation projects, we've made sure that we use the BRE sustainability software. So that's recorded all the way through. So any materials that are coming off the building, that we're able to measure that and then look at how much is recycled and set targets around that. For us, it's an evolving sort of like an evolving approach. So we also look, you know, as a client, making sure that we've got the right digital information that we can pass to our consultants and our contractors, that then allows them to be more innovative in the terms of the solutions that are put in place. In particular, it's really around making sure that when you're carrying out a project like removing a combustible external wall system, that when you're replacing it, you're thinking about the sustainability goals at the same time. So what insulation are you putting back on the building? Now we're thinking about, you know, holistically the sustainable goals for that building, as well as making sure that we make sure it's compliant as well. So that would include PV panels on the roof, thinking about the mechanical extraction, you know, thinking about contextually around things like the introduction of AWOB's law and about how that might affect the users for that for those buildings. And that then we will incrementally evolve and develop that throughout the approach that we want to take with our buildings.
Thank you, Dan. Over to Jason Glasson.
We have a carbon net zero plan, and we are looking for working with our supply chain partners to reduce both the carbon content of materials, but also in the way that we construct. So looking for net zero construction projects is an aim within the plan. And obviously that will take a lot of innovation to deliver. In terms of how we work with partners, obviously we have internal dedicated research and development programs to try and identify solutions to our problems or opportunities that we may be able to exploit with new technology. So that's on one side, but also working with our supply chain partners, we've established a quite a large scale engagement council. And as part of that engagement council, we run a number of innovation competitions. And that gives particularly our small and medium enterprise companies a bit of a shop window, really, to identify some innovative approaches to solving problems on various projects that we have. And the winners of those competitions obviously get that visibility to the rest of a quite a wide range and extensive supply chain, but also can qualify for sponsorship from National Highways then to complete an innovation and sort of bring a market-ready product. A particular example that we had recently was on a major project, an AI tool was developed to mine customer reaction to a scheme and really sort of find out what are people sort of upset about, what irritates people, what are they putting on social media, but maybe not directly contacting National Highways on the various contact lines, and actually understand the problems, understand those pain points, and actually address them, so that when customers are driving through roadworks, which is never necessarily the most pleasant experience, how can we make some of those problems that people have been grumbling about, how can we make them just disappear almost by magic, because we've identified problems, we've picked up trends, and actually in some situations would be able to resolve those completely. I think blockers in that sense can be timescales. So particularly if we're looking on projects to develop an approach and bring it to bear and to bring benefit to a particular project can take some time. And with time constraints on a project and indeed budgetary constraints, actually getting that through, managing the risks and bringing a sort of a risk managed product into service on a particular project, it is those timescales that can interrupt that. Obviously, then we're looking for suppliers to bring that as part of almost their portfolio of things that they bring to projects, so that we can move away from short-term solutions to problems. But actually, this is the way that they work. This is the way that they operate, and bringing that as a culture almost of innovative solutions that are almost business as usual that they bring to all of the projects that we work with them on.
Thanks very much, Jason. Thanks everyone for your answers to that question. On to the next one. What are the most common frustrations clients have with contractors, indeed all suppliers? And are there any recurring themes, lack of transparency, delays? And if you can cite any examples, that would be helpful. We will start with Dan Hollis for this question.
Yeah, I think for me, we sometimes forget that if we have a successful project, everyone should win. And for us, it's the biggest frustration was really around the lack of collaboration. I had to think about sort of like the least successful and the most successful contractor. So the least successful contractor had the breakdown in relationship in terms of ourselves as a client and the contractor was horrendous. And you know, that inability to, once that trust has broken down, it's really difficult to recover that, really difficult to recover that solution. And if I think about the successful ones, you know, when you're looking at buildings which, you know, I'm mainly working on buildings which are occupied, they're quite difficult, often built in the 1960s, 70s. And you are going to come across problems, and to you know, and it's about how you solve those problems in a collaborative way, where you understand what you're doing, you're going together jointly with the same proportionate approach.
Thanks very much, Dan. Over to Jason Glasson.
Okay, I think it's really around for me that almost the start and end of projects, and sort of through the middle, in terms of almost seeing the bigger picture, and actually when we're creating an asset, the end goal of that really as a successful project isn't the creation of a great asset. That's not the end point. The asset only exists to provide the service to our customers, the road users. So it's really, how is that asset going to operate throughout its life? Is it easy to maintain? How disruptive will it be to customers? How long will what will be the frequency of major interventions? And are we really considering those in detail at the design phase, at the construction phase? And are we either looking at individual designs or features within a particular project that will, looking forward, make those elements easier? And maybe they might cost a little more in terms of CapEx costs, but actually in terms of either overall cost, and certainly overall cost to the economy, when we factor in customer disruption, maybe they would be good solutions, but also in terms of our workforce safety. Obviously, every time we intervene on the asset, we're doing so in a live environment that does represent a sort of increase in risk, and we can do everything we can to minimize that exposure to operatives on the network carrying out maintenance activities. If we can eliminate that altogether, that obviously has to be the safest outcome that we achieve. So it really is seeing that bigger picture, understanding that actually an asset has a life cycle, and the creation of the asset is just the start, and having that forward thoughts, not just what does the contract say, but actually understanding what are we trying to achieve as an organization, what do our customers expect from us, and how can our suppliers play a part in that. That's kind of at the beginning of the phase, but also as the construction ends, it is a sort of an historical bugbear, really. How do we hand over the right information, the right data, to be able to manage that asset well throughout its lifespan? Obviously, the largest part of that asset will be spent in operation, but actually we need really good information. We need really good data to underpin that, so that we're efficient and also we're effective, we intervene in the right time, we understand what it will take to maintain that asset. And I remember working on site and it was half completed, as built drawings and into a drawing tank to be stored away forever. That's now data, digital technology, but it still takes that rigor, still takes that discipline at the stage of a project when not so many people are interested in it and people have moved on, the bulk of the teams have sometimes moved on. How can we maintain that interest to get all of that data handed over so that actually we've got a really rich source of information then to successfully manage that asset throughout its life cycle?
Thanks, Jason. A common frustration, I imagine. Over to Julie now.
Oh, it's a long list. Unfortunately, with live hospitals, particularly older hospitals, car parking is always a challenge. And obviously that goes against site compounds and everything. But also, there is an assumption sometimes that we struggle with, that when you've got an inner city hospital or a small community hospital in a poor local environment, they turn up with very posh cars, very expensive cars, which probably half the population can't afford. They assume that they can just take over half the site, including the disabled car parking bays. And you just think, if only they communicated better and didn't assume. Because sometimes these hospitals might have a mental health unit on them, and with that comes mental health problems. You might have patients or relatives of patients who've received bad news. They might have just come out from anesthesia. So you might have a patient who goes, well, you've got to think about the needs that are beyond the normal health and safety, because they might still be recovering from anesthesia for the next couple of hours. And it's they need to talk more to us, because we understand our sites, we understand the buildings, and we understand the patient group within those buildings. So I think there is a huge thing around not forming assumptions, but also that communication. And, you know, turning up with a concrete mixer or doing some angle grinding outside the theatre windows, it makes it very difficult for the surgeons within those rooms. And again, it's about those conversations to minimise that disruption. And they're usually really simple, silly things. You know, invariably with the car parking, we can talk to other providers of the one public estate and say, can you find room for 20 cars couple hundred meters down the road? But it's about that communication. My other big frustration usually is that when we tender a contract and we interview the contractor to talk about their approach to our project, usually they wheeled in the A team and we get this really competent group with really strong CVs and loads of experience. And over 2-3 months, we suddenly find our way, working our way down to the latest apprentice, somebody who's on, you know, just out of university, or unfortunately they've had to pinch the site manager who was doing really well, but they needed emergently on another job. And that also causes frustration for us, because what should have been a really good tight-knit project that we've started building those relationships with, we're now having to rebuild those relationships. And it can be a constant ongoing process, sometimes for 18 months, 2 years. And that can make a project really hard. And because of the ingrained knowledge that you've taught to people about where things are critical on a hospital site, you're now sometimes starting afresh for the third or fourth time explaining things. The other two probably minor frustrations, which I think probably everybody has, is the deluge of documents on a Friday afternoon. I don't know why. Questions or clarifications always 2-3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and then you can't get hold of the person to have that conversation. So you can end up with 20-30 emails that, you know, and they need a response by Monday lunchtime. And it makes it very, very difficult. And it's just forward planning and thinking a little ahead. And the only other one I think that really makes it difficult is handover. I share everybody's frustration about lack of documents. Friday afternoon handovers, or the handover on the day before a bank holiday weekend with very little handover documentation. They are supposed to contractually provide us everything. That doesn't happen usually because there is always this rush at the end to get out that door.
Thank you, Julie. That was a really interesting answer. I'm going to go on to the fourth and final question now, and that is, what one thing would you change to improve collaboration between clients and contractors and all your supply chain, and ultimately improve project delivery? And again, if you've got some good examples of excellent collaboration, it would be interesting to hear about them. So over to Jason.
Okay, so I think obviously the question is largely structured around collaboration between suppliers and sort of us, particularly as a client. I think a lot of the power lies in how we can encourage suppliers to collaborate more with each other. So we see a huge amount of collaboration across the supply chain, directly from the prime contractor right through their supply chain to those small and medium enterprise companies that they work with. And I think really sometimes that's out of our sight, and that's largely a lot of those relationships may be driven by individual contracts across that supply chain, but actually having that true collaboration will really yield results. So really to encourage that, National Highways has set up a supplier development system. It's a bit of a shameless plug, but it's an online tool that suppliers, any supplier can register for if they're interested in working with National Highways. And that really, it's a lot of detail, a lot of information in how to work, how we want suppliers to work with each other, with National Highways, setting out all of our behaviours, values. And it really gives an insight into what does a good supplier, what does a good contractor look like to us? So when we have a successful contract and we walk away, we think they were great partners to work with, really enjoyed, we got everything we wanted from them. Why was that? What made that a successful partnership? A lot of that information now we describe, we try and tell suppliers as much as we can as to what it will take to be a successful supplier with us. And that isn't just cheapest cost and the quickest time and onto the next project. That building that rich relationship with those suppliers is really key to it. And obviously this whole discussion is around collaboration. National Highways invests a lot of time in collaboration with its supply chain partners, really trying to build those relationships with individual companies. And a lot of that is building that expectation as to, like I said, what does it take? What do we expect from our suppliers? What are we looking for in a successful supplier? And really, who are those suppliers that we look forward to working with again? So which will be those ones when they are successfully tendered that we've got a excitement and an anticipation of working with, because we know they're a great supplier, a great partner to work with. So I think a lot of that is around sharing that information, giving those expectations out, making that very, very clear, and then looking to develop on that. So again, that's available on the internet, and I'd encourage organisations to go through that information.
Thanks, Jason. And a nice example there. Over to Julie.
So the successful projects I've run is where the contractor and us as the client have really embraced that partnership working. So we've had a desk or two desks in the site office, and we're there as part of the team to deliver. That allows us to help manage expectations on both sides. Of course, though, we can manage the disruptive elements, the deliveries, that sort of thing. And we can advise what the best times are, and we can put in place newsletters and emails to the hospital operational side. As a client, I think we need to provide more clarity sometimes around our expectations. Things change. Largely, it's down to our personnel. But equally, I think we can manage that. It's just about us being clearer probably on what we want. We are, like any hospital, we have a professional and experienced estates team. And so joint commissioning sometimes is really useful for us, because that makes the handover easier, smoother, and we end up with our engineers knowing what the intricacies are of those systems. And if there are problems or issues, then we can try and iron them out fairly early in the process, and hopefully it avoids the them and us scenario that we sometimes can form, which isn't really helpful for anybody. And joint onboarding helps considerably, where we help as part of the package and their training videos to input what the hospital is about, what is happening on that site. And so that helps with firming up the health and safety element. And so hopefully all that put together brings better value for money to the NHS.
Thank you very much, Julie. Over to Dan Hollis.
Yeah, for us, as I mentioned earlier, the you know, quality was our focus. So I think for us, competence is absolutely key. So that's competence ourselves as a client, competence as our professional consultants and our contractors as well. And thinking about the different projects and what different elements of competence you need for the different projects you're managing. You know, if you think about that division of what skills, experience, knowledge and behaviours is important, then, you know, matching that up before you start projects for us would allow us and does allow us to make sure that we get a better, you know, determines the overall success of the project. In particular, it's around the behaviours. So do you, you know, for us, I see that as critical. So understanding your limitations. I understand, you know, I think I understand my own limitations and that of my consultants and that of the contractor as well. And that understanding that and working together in a collaborative way, we found that works well in establishing those relationships over a period of time to deliver a programme of works, not just an individual project.
Thanks very much, Dan, and thanks everyone. That concludes the round of questions. Thank you to all of you for giving us your time today, much appreciated. Thank you to CIOB and IAM for facilitating, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.
If you would like to share your feedback on the podcast, you can email us at 21cc@atompublishing.co.uk. And if you're on social media, please use the hashtag 21cc to let us know what you think. That's all from me today. Thanks for listening.